All right, I'd like you to take your Bible this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. This will be the 10th commandment, part 3. If you'll recall in the previous two messages, I discussed the fact that the 10th commandment violations are heart sins. Yet, some teachers and authors, having erroneously applied the 7th commandment to exclusively miscegenation, and there aren't a lot that do so, but there are certainly some who do so, because of having erroneously applied the 7th commandment exclusively to miscegenation or interracial relationships, have thus claimed that the 10th commandment, having made that claim, concerns adultery, as it is usually thought of, and that being infidelity. Failing to recognize that if this is true, then consistency demands that the 10th commandment is likewise the commandment that condemns theft as well, because the 10th commandment not only forbids coveting thy neighbor's wife or women, but also your neighbor's possessions. And therefore the 8th commandment, thou shalt not steal, would then also have to be reinterpreted to mean something else than how we would normally think of it, just like they have done with the 7th commandment. This problem is, of course, the result of first not correctly understanding the full scope and intention of the 7th commandment. That not only do those who take that position on the 7th commandment not fully understand, neither does the vast majority of modern Christianity who normally only apply it to infidelity. Both are two extreme positions. But the problem just discussed is a result of those who only apply the 7th commandment to miscegenation and do not understand or do not see the full scope and intent of the 10th commandment, which condemns not only, and certainly does condemn miscegenation, but also all expressions or manifestations of adultery, including infidelity, incest, sodomy, bestiality, and all other biblically defined sexual aberrations, which has thus resulted in their misapplying then the 10th commandment as well, because they know there has to be something that deals with infidelity, and so they've misapplied the 10th commandment to infidelity as a consequence. The 10th commandment addresses heart sins, which some authors and expositors have a difficult time with, arguing how can merely a heart sin be a transgression of Yahweh's laws? How can intent alone, without it actually being carried out or consummated, be a violation of Yahweh's laws? And at first, it sounds like that sounds like a pretty good argument. In fact, I was just reading other authors on the 10th commandment, which I usually do after I've exhausted my study itself on the scriptures themselves. I was, in fact, quite amazed at how many, Russ Dooney included, which I was kind of taken back with, that take that position. And therefore their question is, how can intent alone be a transgression of Yahweh's laws? Well, for one answer, and I'm not sure it's the only answer, but certainly for one answer to that question is, how about simply because Yahweh says it is? That probably should be enough, don't you think? Because Yahweh principally looks not at men's outward appearance or conduct, but at men's hearts. You know, when Samuel was sent to anoint a new king over Israel, when he did so, why was David chosen over his eldest brother, Eliab? Anybody want to tell me? Why was David chosen over his eldest brother, Eliab? Well, if your answer is because of David's heart, normally when we think of David being chosen, he was chosen because he was a man after Yahweh's heart, right? But if your answer is because of David's heart, you're only partially correct. It was because of both David's and Eliab's hearts. It wasn't just because of David's. Certainly remember what Yahweh told Samuel, and in fact, which was principally focused on Eliab's heart, not David's. In 1 Samuel 16:7, it says, "But Yahweh said unto Samuel, Look not on his countenance or the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For Yahweh seeth not as man seeth. For a man looketh on the outward appearance, but Yahweh looketh on the heart." So it wasn't just David's heart. It was Eliab's heart. It was David's heart that qualified him. It was Eliab's heart that disqualified him. And of course, Yahweh is the only one who can see into men's hearts. The Pharisees demonstrated that a man can look outwardly righteous, but be rotten to the core. Whitened sepulchers, as Yeshua described them, full of rotting corpses. Alive on the outside, but dead on the inside. It's no different today with today's Pharisees, many who wear the title politician. You know, every 4 years we are provided candidates who are made to appear to the people as outwardly, quote unquote, righteous. Righteous, of course, according to contemporary man standards, certainly not Yahweh's standards, but they are presented as being outwardly, quote unquote, righteous to the people, but who time and again are proven to be within nothing but rotting corpses with no moral compass whatsoever. So this whole idea of Phariseeism is certainly not a dead issue today. We certainly have, both in politics as well and in many churches today, the same problem as well. By the way, alone, this demonstrates what I just talked about as it concerns politicians. This alone demonstrates the importance of someday dumping America's counterfeit and fundamentally flawed election process and reinstating Yahweh's system of appointments, which places the choice of any two or more candidates squarely and solely in the hands of Yahweh, who knows the hearts of men, the only one who knows the hearts of men. How is that accomplished? For those who may not have heard me speak on this before, and it almost is shocking to even think about how this is accomplished, but it's, when you really think about it, it is so absolutely perfect. And by the way, I should talk about between two or more biblically qualified candidates. It's accomplished. How do we put it so that Yahweh is the one who chooses? By throwing lots, like was done in Acts chapter 1. You go back to throwing lots. If there are two biblically qualified men, you've already won, no matter which one you get. But God can look deeper than the outward manifestations and know the heart as well. And so you throw lots and you put it in the hands of Yahweh, who promises to give us a perfect lot if we're seeking His will. Another reason why some expositors and teachers are hesitant to apply the 10th commandment exclusively to heart sins is because of man's attempt to regulate, prosecute, and punish matters of the heart, which they identify. How do they identify the matters of the heart? Thought or hate crimes. Thought or hate crimes. And of course, the quote-unquote crimes that they identify as hate crimes are not necessarily what Yahweh would identify as crimes, but what men have taken upon themselves to identify as hate or thought crimes, which invariably amount to Isaiah 5 and verse 20, that is, to of what Isaiah describes there as calling evil good and good evil, such as preaching against sodomy, becoming more and more something that is being judged as a thought or hate crime in the days in which we find ourselves living today. Talk about an upside-down world. We are that already and becoming worse as time goes on. But while such expositors are justified in their concerns regarding this abuse by man of judging and prosecuting and judging and punishing thought crimes, their idea of thought crimes, the fact is man is not allowed to judge matters of the heart. Can you think of anything in the scriptures that provides man the right to judge matters of the heart in any fashion? Man is not allowed to judge matters of the heart, and this is why it is important that we guard ourselves against presumption and judging another man's motives, which is more often the cause, the prime cause for many divisions within the amongst the body of Christ. It's because of judging the motives of men's heart rather than going to them and finding out what the reasons for their actions that we presume to be based upon this or that, and which is impossible for us to know. How can you judge the motives of my heart? How can I judge the motives of your heart? How can any man judge the motives of another man's heart? It's impossible for us to know unless that person himself or herself reveals it to us. And which is why Yahweh, therefore, reserves the right to judge and punish sins of the heart, which only he can see. And for that reason, the 10th commandment, being the only commandment that is solely focused on men's hearts, has no accompanying judgment by which man can punish it. And therefore, for a man to attempt to punish heart or thought crimes, even those defined as such by Yahweh, is in fact an act of humanism, and therefore thus a usurpation of Yahweh's place as God. Pretty serious that we understand that, because if we start judging each other's hearts, we have therefore placed ourselves in that regard in the place of Yahweh, who is the only one can judge the heart, because he's the only one that can see into the heart of man. What did he tell Samuel? Yahweh doesn't look at man the way you look at him. Why? Because it's impossible. You can flip it around, because it's impossible for us to look at man the way that Yahweh does, because only he can look at the heart. In his book, The World Under God's Law, on page 113, Robert Ingram provided an illustration from the comic strip Mutt and Jeff. I don't even know if that's still a comic strip. Don't recognize it myself. I've heard the name, but I don't know what it is. But anyway, it doesn't matter. He writes, quote, "Mutt and Jeff were playing big league baseball. Jeff was the umpire. Mutt was up to bat." I think I'd rather be Jeff than Mutt. Anyway, Jeff warned him that any vile language or abuse of the umpire would get him thrown out of the game. At the next pitched ball, he called a wild strike. Mutt said nary a word, just looked at Jeff. Jeff threw him out of the game. And when Mutt protested that he hadn't said a word, Jeff said, "No, but oh, what you were thinking." He was trying to judge the heart, the mind of the man. And in fact, Ingram went on to even use this illustration himself to attempt to prove that the 10th commandment is more than a heart sin. But it is a heart sin, regardless of what man does it. And he was dealing with the abuse of man trying to judge the heart. Despite man's abuse, doesn't change the fact that this is indeed a heart sin. It is a heart sin that ultimately only Yahweh can, and as we will see when we finally do get to the judgment aspect of this, not only can, but will judge, in fact. You know, the Ten Commandments, I talked about this, I think, in one of the previous two messages, that the order, that some people might think, well, if this is the cause of, or the root cause the heart sins of coveting, greed, and lust, and so forth, are the root cause of these other commandments, one might think that it should have probably preceded the other commandments. But if you think about it, the order of the Ten Commandments makes perfect sense. Certainly, it makes perfect sense that Yahweh would begin with the first commandment with himself. You know, after all, the beginning of wisdom and knowledge and understanding is the fear of Yahweh. That's the beginning of all of that. So thus, the Yahweh begins with commandment one, thou shalt have no other gods before me. It also makes sense, at least it does to me, and Yahweh may have another reason for why he did what he did in the order, but it certainly makes sense to me then that he would then culminate the Ten Commandments with us, with you and me, but with more than just you or me. You know, he kind of is dealing with us all the way through, but he ends with a commandment that deals with more than you and me as with the other commandments, but that he culminates with a commandment that deals more than with just the flesh and blood, you and me, but with our real essence, our hearts. That he starts with himself and he ends with our hearts, without which we too are nothing more than whitened sepulchres, which has more often than not throughout the Old Testaments and the Gospels been the principal problem that God keeps coming back with and deals with. You know, it's the first, you look at like Isaiah chapter 1 and some of the other passages, and it's always, there were many a time when the men that were the Israelites who were being dealt with were keeping the commandments, at least the first nine, at least to maybe a better degree than otherwise. And it was always you may be keeping, you may be sacrificing, you may be doing all these things, you may be going to worship, but where's your heart? Isaiah chapter 1 again deals with that very thing, and it's certainly the case as well today. Listen, Yahweh wants our hearts as much as any husband does that of his wife. And thus he requires that what we do for him and for his kingdom be not merely mechanical obedience, but expressions that originate with and that are animated or emanate from or by the heart. And therefore, it is necessary that we not only address the outward violations of Yahweh's commandments, but also that we address, more importantly than even addressing the outward manifestations of Yahweh's commandments, that we address a heart that's not fully given to Yahweh, and without which the sin has yet to be truly dealt with. If we never get to the heart of the issue, then the sin is never addressed with. We must get to the heart. Now, when it comes to heart sins, it's interesting that they appear, and I may have not have thought of all of them, but they certainly appear to be all interrelated with covetousness, lust, greed, jealousy, envy, and even grumbling and complaining that we find dealt with by Paul in the New Testament, while not heart sins themselves, emanate from one or all of these sins usually. They are all either manifestations of the same thing, related sins, or the consequence of covetousness. And therefore, the commands against such are, therefore, Tenth Commandment statutes. Take envy, for example. Envy, like lust, is simply a manifestation of covetousness. Covetousness is usually aimed at another's possessions, which often culminates. Covetousness is often aimed, the word covetousness, at least as we use it, is often aimed at another person's possessions, which often culminates in principally the Eighth Commandment and sometimes the Sixth and Ninth Commandment violations, as it did with Ahab's coveting Nadab's vineyard. But it principally culminates often, or often principally culminates, in the eighth commandment transgression. Lust is usually aimed at another, as we use the word. Lust is usually aimed at another man's wife or woman, and which often culminates in seventh commandment violations. And envy is usually aimed at another's fame or position or achievements or success or notoriety, which often culminates in ninth commandment violations. Now, any of those can extend into some of the other commandment, even murder, of course, sixth commandment violations as well. And, of course, now talking about envy, of course, it is a heart sin as well. As depicted by Solomon in Proverbs chapter 14, in verse 30, he begins by saying, "A sound heart is life of the flesh." Certainly physically, a sound heart is life of the flesh. But spiritually as well, right? A sound heart is life to the flesh. And in fact, he's principally talking about spiritually here, as you will see. A sound heart is life to the flesh, but he contrasts it with envy. Envy is the rottenness of the bones. Envy is the rottenness of the bones. Envy leads, think about this, what does envy lead to often? Envy leads to resentment and to the begrudging of others and what of their achievements or what they may have, and often, therefore, hate as well. And therefore, it is indeed rottenness in the bones, you know, envy envy and resentment and begrudgment and hate. That's all of that is rottenness in the bones. The today's English version, as usual, translates it a little bit differently. It says peace of mind, or it could have said heart, peace in the heart. Peace of mind makes the body healthy. But jealousy, use jealousy instead of envy, but jealousy is like a cancer. And indeed it is, at least if it continues and is not dealt with. Someone described jealousy as nothing but poisonous envy. And in fact, I think that's a pretty good description. It was envy. Think about this. It was envy and jealousy that precipitated in Joseph's brothers selling him into slavery. That's where it came from, that heart sin of envy or jealousy. Acts 17:9, if you don't know the story and don't know that that's the case, it's spelled out in Acts 17:9, where it says, "And the patriarchs, moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt." When they should have instead practiced what Paul wrote about in Romans 12 and verse 13, that is to rejoice with those to rejoice, to be glad when someone else is honored or elevated or blessed by Yahweh's prosperity in whatever fashion he may bless someone. Rejoice, it says, to rejoice with those. As in 1 Corinthians 12. In fact, let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. As in what we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, which you'll probably recognize as a chapter, one of the two chapters, Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12, that deals with the body relationship, the relationship between the body as a whole and the relationship between the members. Look particularly at verses 25 and 26, where it says, "After the same manner also he took a cup." That's not what I want. That's 11. 1 Corinthians 12, 25 and 26. "That there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And whether one member suffer, all the members suffer with it. Or whether one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it." You know, if we're one body, and sometimes we need to visualize ourselves more in that fashion, because that's what we are. We're one body. He's the head. We're the body. We go where he goes. We're all to follow him, although not in the same sense as the physical body that we can look right at and it has no choice to go but where the head goes. It is nonetheless the illustration that twice God provided us, that we are one body. He is our head, and that we need to visualize ourselves as that, with being individual members, whether it be a digit on our hand or whether it be the hand or the arm or the leg or whatever other part of the body. We are one body. And if we realize that and we visualize that and we accept that and we look at each other in that same equality of individual members of one overall body, if one member is elevated, then we ought to rejoice. Because if it's elevated, then we're elevated with it. If one member suffers, if the fingernail on my little finger or on my little toe gets damaged, I guarantee it is not the only thing that suffers. I suffer because it's a part of my body. We're to rejoice with those who rejoice, and we're to weep with those who weep. Why? Because as the body goes, I go. As the body goes, you go. And therefore, we are all one body. And whereas they should have rejoiced with what was happening with Joseph, instead they did the exact opposite. And they became envious and jealous of him. Envy was one of the root causes for why the Pharisees and the scribes were so intent on killing Yeshua. Now, God's providence was in all of it, but he took advantage of their envy and their jealousy to accomplish what had to be accomplished in Yeshua being killed. Turn over to John chapter 11. John chapter 11, and look at verses 46 through 48 to begin with. John 11, 46, it says, "But some of them went their way to the Pharisees and told them what things Yeshua had done." What had he done? If you read that alone, it's like, man, you can't believe what he did. What had he done? Well, you don't have to go very far before that, and you'll see what he had done was raise Lazarus from the dead. Boy, they ought to have been excited about that. But they go and they run to the Pharisees and tell them what Yeshua had done. Verse 47, "Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, 'What do we? For this man doeth many miracles.'" And then in verse 48 it says, "And if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation." What was that? It's envy. It's jealousy. You know, we will no longer have the key places in the kingdom. We can't let this go on. Instead of rejoicing with what he had accomplished and seeing him for who he was, instead their jealousy and envy resulted in what? Jump down to verse 53. "Then from that day forth they took counsel together to put him to death." All because of that simple little sin, or what we sometimes see as so innocuous, called envy and called jealousy. We're also told in Acts 17 and verse 5, it says that the Jews which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of a baser sort, and look at how this just builds. It says that the Jews, which were principally Judahites, which believed not, moved with envy. There is where it began, that heart sin. But watch how it builds. "Took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, and gathered a company, and set all of the city in an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring him out to the people." All because of envy, that little innocuous sin that nobody really seems too concerned about. Why? Why would they do that? Verse 6, "And when they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, 'These that have turned the world upside down have come hither also.'" Their world, they realized their world was being turned upside down. Their world was being turned upside down, and they were getting envious of those who were on their way to the top, meaning they were on their way to the bottom. And they became envious, and all of that was the result of that sin envy. And listen, we might want to take note of that, because we can expect the same response. We shouldn't be taken surprised by the same response in persecution whenever Christianity begins to once again become Christendom and thereby begin to turn today's New World Order upside down. We can expect the same thing will take place, at least to some degree. But like covetousness, let me ask you this. Like covetousness, is there such a thing as righteous or godly envy and or jealousy? They're kind of pretty much sister sins, if not the same thing, and just described with different words. Is there such a thing as righteous or godly envy or jealousy? Well, there's one verse that puts an end to that whole discussion real quickly. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2, where it says, Paul writes, and he says, I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy. I think there's godly jealousy, just like there is godly coveting. He says, I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy, for I espoused you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. In 1 Kings chapter 19, Elijah is described as being jealous for Yahweh. I'd call that a godly or a righteous jealousy. I'll bet Yahweh does too. In the Old Testament, moreover, is replete with passages describing Yahweh himself as being a jealous God. Remember, it even says his name is jealous, that he's a jealous God over that which belonged to him. That is, particularly his wife and her affections. Therefore, indeed, there is a godly jealousy. Therefore, jealousy, like covetousness, is not inherently evil. It, once again, depends upon what it's focused or fixated on. All depends on the focus of the jealousy, the focus of the envy, the focus of the covetousness. Is what determines whether it's godly or otherwise. But otherwise, we need to shun this sin in all of its forms. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 2, we find the following. It says, wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile, heart sins, that pretty much originate with covetousness, but he's not going to leave it unmentioned anyway, and hypocrisies and envies and evil speaking. Put them away, he says. Get rid of them. Get them out of your life. 2 Corinthians 7:1, Paul wrote something similar. He says, having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, man, you got all these promises, he said, now let's deal with what we need to deal with. Therefore, having all of these promises that he's previously in chapter 6 just enumerated, he says, having therefore all of these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness. New American Standard says defilements of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Note, there's no holiness. First of all, note, there is no holiness in the sight of God if we only cleanse ourselves of the defilements of the flesh. That which is dealt with in the first 9 commandments, particularly the 5th through the 9th commandments. There is no perfecting holy. There is no holiness, perfecting holiness in the sight of God if we only address the defilements of the flesh. We must also address the defilements of the spirit or the heart. The heart sins such as covetousness and lust and greed and other manifestations of the same thing. Let's discuss for just a little bit the related sin of greed. Whereas greed can be the impetus behind covetousness and eventually stealing, of course, as well, greed is also itself just another form of covetousness. Covetousness is the inordinate desire for what belongs to someone else. The inordinate desire of what belongs to someone else. That's covetousness. Greed, on the other hand, follow with me on this. Even when it's not focused, greed, even when it's not focused on, as it often can be and is, but even when it's not focused on what belongs to your brother or neighbor, it is the nonetheless covetousness of what belongs to another. Did you catch that? Even when it's not focused on what belongs to your brother or neighbor, it is nonetheless covetousness of what belongs to another. What other? If not my neighbor and my brother, what other? How about Yahweh? How about Yahweh? Achan's. What was Achan's sin? Achan's was this type of covetousness. The silver and the garment that he coveted and took in the destruction and the siege upon Jericho no longer belonged to another man. And therefore, it wasn't covetousness of the nature of someone else, his neighbor or his brother, but it was devoted to Yahweh. It was also the same sin that was committed by Elijah's servant Gehazi. Remember Gehazi? When in 2 Kings 5, he pursued Naaman after he had been baptized seven times in the Jordan, and went on cleansed from his leprosy. When in 2 Kings 5, Gehazi then pursued Naaman after he was headed back to Syria for, now think about this, he pursued after Naaman for, Naaman was already willing to give it up, so he wasn't pursuing what was Naaman's, but he pursued Naaman for 2 talents of silver and 2 changes of clothes. It was pursuing that which really wasn't Naaman's. Naaman had brought it to give it away. And therefore, it was what belonged to Yahweh, and for which Gehazi himself became a leper. Don't think that God doesn't judge this sin. 17th century Presbyterian minister Thomas Watson, in his book, The Ten Commandments, on page 175, put it in the following fashion. He wrote, quote, "A man is given to covetousness when he so sets his heart upon worldly things." When he so sets his heart upon worldly things. He's not talking about the things of others, the possessions of others. He's just talking about setting the heart on worldly things. "That for the love of them," now listen to this, "he will part with the heavenly. For the wedge of gold, he will part with the pearl of price." When Christ said to the young man in the gospel, "Sell all and come and follow me," he went away sorrowful. In Matthew 19 and verse 22, he would rather part with Christ than with his earthly possessions. End of quote. Thus, greed was also the sin of the rich young ruler. It's not as if, you know, that sin is not addressed in the Bible. Come on. And it must be addressed in the Ten Commandments. I think Herschel had mentioned that when I had asked the question, what seems to be conspicuously missing in the Tenth Commandment? And I was actually dealing with something else, but money itself isn't mentioned. You know, the greed, the lust for just money, for possessions. Well, it's indeed there, because we're not to covet that which belongs to another. And if it's not somebody else's, our coveting, our lusting for it, then it's, if it's not somebody else's, it's Yahweh's. Greed was also at the sin of this rich young ruler, whom, although he claimed to be obedient to all of the commandments, was nonetheless required by Yeshua. Yeshua did not challenge that in and of itself, but he nonetheless was required by Yeshua to sell all of his possession and give the proceeds to the poor. Why would he make that demand? It's not a universal demand upon everyone. Why did he make this of this rich young ruler? Because Yeshua knew his heart, and that his sin was greed, not for the wealth of someone else, but simply for his own, or for what he thought was his own, but which was in fact Yahweh's, demonstrated, something that's often missed, demonstrated in that Yeshua had the authority to command what to do, command him what to do with his wealth. Obviously, it wasn't his. It was Yeshua's, or Yeshua would not have had that authority to tell him what to do with it. Any more than today's government doesn't have the right, except by theft, to tell us what to do with what's ours. Yeshua would have been no different, unless that the possessions of that young man really belonged to him. And in fact, when you understand that he owns the entire world, in fact, the entire universe, what he owns and what we owned, in fact, does belong to him. Greed is therefore a sin that may or may not involve other men's possessions. And that may never lead to theft, but can simply, and that's one of the problems with those who think that it's more than just a sin of the heart. Because if you make it more than the sin of the heart, then you got to alleviate this idea of greed. Because they want to add then in the sin of theft as well. But greed is therefore a sin that may or may not involve the possessions of others, and that may never lead to theft, but can simply be an inordinate desire to have more, often described as either the love of money or materialism. And as such, supplants or usurps Yahweh's place in one's heart. And for that reason, it is identified by Paul as idolatry. Colossians 3:5. Let me read it to you from the New American Standard Version. It says, "Therefore consider the members of your earthly body as dead," speaking to Christians, "as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry." In Ephesians 5:5, New American Standard translated a related word in the following fashion. Didn't translate it greed, but a root word that came from the previous root word. He says, "For this you know with certainty that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." Now, bear in mind that not all idolatry. One of the authors that I read made this mistake. Not all idolatry is covetousness or greed. There's lots of different forms of idolatry. And covetousness and greed may have no part in it whatsoever. But all covetousness and greed amounts to idolatry. Heart idolatry. Replacing Yahweh's place on the throne of our heart with something else. In Matthew 13 and verse 22, in the parable of the sower, the deceitfulness of riches is described as choking the word, the written word in that case. But it might also be thought of as choking the word made flesh right out of our lives. And in fact, it did that with the rich young ruler, didn't it? He walked away saddened because his riches had his heart. Think about it. Idolatry amounts to our will, our pleasures, our desires or lusts versus Yahweh's. And thus, indeed, idolatry is at the core of covetousness and greed. It is a sin that amounts to seeking our kingdom versus seeking Yahweh's kingdom. It's the difference between what's described in Luke chapter 12 in the parable of the rich man who had made no provision for his soul, if you remember, at the end of the day, and which was preceded by Yeshua's warning in Luke chapter or in verse 15, where he said, quote, "Take heed and beware of covetousness." This man was covet. He wasn't a thief. It didn't appear that there's any indication that he was seeking what belonged to somebody else, but he was still identified by Yeshua as a covetous man who just simply wanted more and more and more and more. And he says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesses." Now note, it doesn't say there's anything wrong with having the abundance of things. Sometimes that's the blessing of Yahweh. But he says your life doesn't consist in the abundance of the things you possess. And contrasted with Matthew chapter 6, verses 20, 21, 24, and 33, it says, But lay up for yourselves treasures, let your treasures be in heaven, where neither moth nor rust does corrupt, and where thieves do not break through and steal. For where your treasure is, even though you may have lots of other treasures, again, hopefully blessings from Yahweh. He says, "For where your treasure is, there will be your heart also." Verse 24, he says, "No man can serve two masters, for you either hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." You can serve God with your mammon, But you can't serve God and mammon as two different masters. And then in verse 33 that we know so well, it says, but seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all of these things shall be added unto you. One of the ways that we can seek first his kingdom is, no matter whether we're poor or rich or something in between, is to take whatever possessions he has given us and use them in seeking first his kingdom. Keeping things in their right position, keeping him on the throne of our heart rather than something else. It's the difference between those who would exchange the pearl of great price for a wedge of silver or gold, and those who understand that their very soul alone is worth more than the entire world. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 26. On page 174, Thomas Watson put it, quote, he may be said to be covetous, not only who gets the world unrighteously, the covetous leads to taking from someone else what doesn't belong to him. He said he may be said to be covetous, not only he who gets the world unrighteously, but he who loves it inordinately, even when it doesn't lead to theft of another. Covetousness, thou shalt not covet, the 10th commandment entails both. One way to describe covetousness is as the desire for more at others' expense, without the responsibility that accompanies it otherwise. Covetousness is the desire for more at others' expense, which almost might seem contrary to what I've already said, particularly in this message in the last part of it. But in fact, it is. It is always at others' expense. Yours, your fellow man's, and Yahweh's. It is always at the expense of someone. A heart sin that must be dealt with. Even if everything else is dealt with, Yahweh, even if you're obedient to everything else, Yahweh wants our heart. He principally wants the heart of his wife. Let's stand. We'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we come before you at this time, Lord, asking that you'd forgive us, Lord, of this sin that sometimes rears its ugly head in our hearts and our minds, and sometimes, Father, not so easily detected. And we just ask that you would help us to deal with it, Lord, and to eradicate it from our lives when, in fact, it does appear, knowing that, bottom line, it is probably the most destructive of all sins. And that leads us to those things, if not taken care of, can lead us to those things that you've commanded against in the other commandments. Lord, we enthrone you upon our hearts, and we, Father, turn away our hearts and our minds from everything else that would come in between us and you. Help us to understand the true importance of this commandment and all that it means, and that it is indeed at the bottom of not only our obedience to the other commandments, but also our relationship with you. We praise you, we thank you, we ask these things in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.